This is the Improve Photography Podcast, episode number 93. Everybody, and welcome back to the Improve Photography Podcast. I am your host, Jim Harmer, and today we are here to talk with all of you, the photo nerds across the world. Some of you are brand new photographers, and others of you are professionals who've been shooting for a long, long time. But today we have questions from the listeners, and here to answer them, I am joined by my friend, Darren Meller.
Hey, Jim, how are you today?
I am doing good. We are recording this a couple days in advance because as you listen to this, I am with a group of about 20 readers or readers of improvephotography.com, listeners of the podcast, and we are in Iceland shooting. I've been so excited for this shoot for a long time, and even more fun that we can do it as one of our free photo workshops. So if you haven't checked them out, go to improvephotography.com/travel group. And I've created a new page there. Before, we used to just send everybody to a Facebook group and you could kind of grab all the info. Now I have a nice page on the website at improvephotography.com/travel group. And that's our free photo workshop series. It'll list exactly what trips are coming up, how to get involved. And when I say free, I mean de grasa is free. You can look at it. You can come shoot with me and Darren. Darren's coming on one of the trips next year and hopefully more. And we'll just go to a location, scout it out, we'll shoot together, we'll help you with your photos, we'll, you know, share ideas with each other, we'll eat at the same restaurants and talk and geek out on the trips. It's just really, really fun. Most of the people who come to a travel group event don't know anybody else who's there, so you don't have to be bashful. Everybody's kind of new. We're just all interested in photography, and it's just a fun opportunity to shoot together. Most photographers charge thousands of dollars to go on trips like this with an experienced photographer who can show you around, and we're charging nothing. It's our way of giving back to the community. We're doing them all around the world. We've already done, I think, five we've done so far, and we have, hopefully we're going to do one a month during 2015. So we're traveling around. We want to spend time with you and shoot. So check out improvephotography.com/travel group and see if there's a trip you can fly out to meet us on, or maybe we're coming to your neck of the woods.
And I can't wait to see what photos you come up with. And with the link that you mentioned there, is it possible for users to go in and suggest an area? Because I did have a student on photoclasses.com recommend that we go to Pennsylvania. It's actually dedicated for astrophotography. It's very, very dark there. They have very minimal light pollution. So she wanted a way to suggest an area for us to visit.
Yeah, I've been seeing some people commenting on that post on improvephotography.com/travel group suggesting places to go. And I'm all about it. Some of our best travel group events are places that I'd never even been to, don't really know anything about. But there was a local photographer who did know it and kind of put together our itinerary of where to shoot and stuff. So if that's you, you want to put together a group, you know, go post it and hopefully we'll be able to get a group together. We have listeners all around the world. And so wherever you want to shoot, there's probably a group of local photographers who listen to the show or are interested in coming and shooting with us. So it's just been really fun. And I enjoy it as a way to, you know, to give back, to help photographers individually. And I think it's a really cool thing that we can do for free. So you just pay your own travel expenses, but you don't owe Improve Photography a dime for those free workshops that we're doing.
Awesome. Well, let's dive into some listener questions. And the first one we have is about family portraits.
Hi, Jim. This is Krista from North Carolina. I have a question about family portraits. I'm just getting into photography, and I did my first family portrait session the other day, and I have another one coming up in the next few months. I wasn't sure where to even begin as far as settings on my camera. I had my external flash, and I have a Canon Rebel T2i. And I had a 24-105 f4 lens. So I used aperture priority mode, but I'm not sure that was the best choice because I did notice a lot of noise in some of my photos. The pictures were taken in the woods, and there was good lighting, but I guess it had to compensate and cranked up the ISO in some of the photos. So I was just wondering where to start with that. I want to be able to get all the faces in focus. I wasn't sure what aperture to even put it on, so I just tried a few different ones. So anyways, if you could give me any tips on family portraits and how to just What's a go-to quick and easy way to just start shooting and get lots of great pictures with lots of clear faces? And also, if there are any tips as far as composition, I feel like the way that I cropped some of the photos, just as I was taking them, not in post-processing, but the angles weren't right or something. I just didn't do a good job getting the full pretty effect of the woods behind the family.
All right, Jim. So what are your thoughts on family portraits? To me, it seems like she's shooting a little bit correctly by using aperture priority, which I would do as well, but we can also control our ISO. Sometimes when we flip over to aperture priority, we forget that ISO is still controllable over there. So when I flip there, I flip into ISO 100 right away. So what are your thoughts at first?
Yeah, that was, I jumped on the same thing that you did. She said that she was shooting in aperture priority mode, so she got grainy photos. You can still control your ISO and your aperture when you're in aperture priority. When you're in shutter priority, you control the shutter and the ISO, and the camera picks the aperture. So the graininess of the photo is still in your control in aperture priority. For shooting family photos, this is kind of my go-to. This is what I would do if I'm, brand new. This is what I would do. Flip it into aperture priority mode. If you have depth between the people, you have one person and then, a little bit behind, somebody else's face is a little bit staggered behind, then you may want to stop down to f5.6, f7.1, f8. You really won't need to go more than that. You certainly don't need to get into f22 mode when we're shooting a family portrait. We just need a little bit more depth of field because there are more people in the photo and we want to make sure everybody's sharp. But when you're shooting in a park, in a forest like she was, you would be surprised how dark it is, even if it's during the day. I have recently shot two different portrait sessions in a forest or a park area where there was a lot of trees. And I found that even, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I was at ISO 800 a lot of times because I was wanting to be in the shadows to have even light over the people. And you'd be surprised how dark it can be in a treed area, even if it's during the day. So you may find that there is a tiny bit more noise in the picture, but sometimes it's just what you need. It's better than having a blurry picture from too slow of a shutter speed. And depending on how your camera handles that, there could be a tiny bit of noise, but sometimes that's just what it is. There may just need to be a little bit of noise in the photo. I wouldn't concern myself too much with that. And then she also asks about composition and making the forest look pretty. The key to making the forest look pretty is don't allow for hard filtered light to enter the frame anywhere in the picture. So you go into a forest and it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the sun is shining, and there's going to be tons of hard filtered light. Now by hard light, I mean that it jumps from highlight to shadow quickly. There's a hard edge along the highlights. And by filtered light, I mean it's coming through the trees so that, when the light comes through all the leaves, there's just a ton of little hot spots all over the ground. And no matter what you do, if there's that hard filtered light going through the picture, it's going to look awful. So your goal as you're walking through the treed area or the forest for this family photo session is don't look for, ooh, that's a pretty tree. Don't look for, ooh, that's a pretty creek. You're looking for where can I go that there's no filtered light. And when you find that nice shaded area, or if it's at a time of day where there isn't any filtered light, then you're going to get really nice shots and that forest is going to look beautiful.
It will, and I would also bring a reflector to reflect any light when you find that perfect area, or possibly some speed lights. I know that brings more gear and more dynamic into the equation of what you have to carry with you to get the photos taken care of. But I mean, when you start to find out that you can take complete control over the light when you're in that nice area with where the ambient light's working for you, I think it's well worth it.
Yep, good point. Let's go to the next question. Looking for a gear recommendation. I love spending people's money.
Hello, Jim. This is Dale Miller from Glenwood, Iowa. I have a question. My son and I are getting ready next weekend to go take pictures of the sandhill crane, like probably at least a 400 millimeter lens, so I'm going to have to rent one. My question is, do you believe a 300 2.8 with the image stabilization on a crop sensor with my SL1 would work better than maybe a 100-400 with the image stabilization on my 6D. Possibly maybe putting a 2X converter on that 100-400 to extend the range. It's going to be low light in the morning, so I'm thinking I probably need a 2.8 aperture. That's the question, and I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
You ever heard of this guy, Darren?
I don't know. He sounds a little bit familiar. So Emily did do some digging on some older recordings with some older questions. I actually smiled when I saw this one come across.
This is Darren's dad that called in the question, and it's a good one. So in this situation, for me personally, I would pick the 300-28. The Canon 100-400, in fact, we were just talking about this before we started recording. Canon has been so slow to update this lens. When was the 100-400 released, Darren?
1998, over a decade ago.
That is an old lens. But, it's still a good lens. It's decent. There are a number of problems with it. You know, by 1998 standards, it's a very sharp lens. But for today's lenses and what we can do, it's not as sharp of a lens as we can do today. Also, it's a push-pull lens. Instead of spinning or twisting the barrel of the lens to get more focal length, to zoom the lens, you physically slide it in and out. And so it can suck up dust and stuff into the lens. So it's not as durable for that reason. But it's a good lens. It's a heavier lens than you may expect it to be. It's an okay lens for wildlife photography. But for me personally, I like the 300-28 given the choice between the two. 300-28 is a lot more of an expensive lens, but I would probably pick it, especially where you're on a crop sensor camera, and a sandhill crane is a pretty large bird. So as long as you can get into a reasonable distance, I think you're going to be just fine. He also mentioned using a teleconverter. I have mentioned before on the podcast, I know I'm in the minority. Wildlife photographers use them all the time. Sports photographers use them all the time. I can't stand them. I just have vowed no more teleconverters. Every time I use it, I just look at the photo and I think, this could look so much sharper without the teleconverter. Even if sometimes it's less bad than other times, I'm not happy with it. But that's just me personally.
Yeah, and I sent him a text message prior to us recording, and he said, yeah, I was happy with using the SL1 with the 300. He didn't want to get the 400mm just because it had a different mount on the bottom, and he wasn't prepared with the right tripod to have that correct mount on there. So the pictures turned out really well. He used both the crop sensor and the 6D with the full frame, but he was actually more satisfied. And this is why Jim and I can't stress enough that crop sensors are different than full frame, but they are advantageous because the shots where he shot on the SL1, the birds were much closer. Even though they're larger birds, we did find out that the blind areas where you're shooting from are much further back there. I mean, we were the people that didn't have the f2.8 400mm lens with a teleconverter on there, but still in the same respect, I think we were well equipped.
Yep, very good.
Hey, Jim, it's Darren Miller from Southwest Iowa, and I wanted to first of all thank you for providing the advice on how to get press credentials to a sporting event. Due to listening to your advice, I'm on the verge of getting some credentials to shooting the Formula One race in Barcelona, Spain, so I thank you and Dave Black for that. My question, however, is now that I took the advice of getting a crop sensor camera instead of getting two full frames, what do you recommend using, a pistol grip tripod or with a ball head, or do you suggest using a monopod for action like a Formula One race? Because I know it's going to be quite high-paced and a lot of fast-moving action. So if you can answer that, I'd appreciate it. I appreciate everything you do, and the online classes are really, really beneficial. Thanks, Jim.
All right, this is going to be really weird. If you're new to the podcast, you're wondering, what is happening right now? This guy is asking himself questions.
It's the Twilight Zone.
Yeah, right. So Darren has been a longtime listener of the podcast and a student on photoclasses.com. And when we had an opening to have somebody else on the podcast, Darren was a sure bet for the podcast, because I think it's awesome that Darren understands friends where all of you are coming from, because only a few months ago he was listening to the podcast, and he's become an incredible photographer. Darren's doing just great things and learning very quickly, and I think it's awesome to have that perspective. So we had a couple questions that got lost in a folder on my wife's computer that we've dug up, and we saw this one, and it's just too funny. We had to include it. So Darren, you know, talk to yourself from a year ago or whenever the question was submitted, and tell me how the shoot went and what you decided to do.
Well, I found that you needed to be on the go at a Formula One shoot. We didn't have the pit access. We just had access to the paddock area, which was a nice walkway over where the drivers were coming into pit. And then they came by the main finish line for each lap. And I used neither, actually. I bought a gimbal head from the camera store because the guy at the store thought, he said, yeah, this is the ultimate panning head that you can buy for your tripod. So I was sold on it. I lugged it around Europe for 46 days, didn't use it once. And quite honestly, I just used the sheer speed of the 70D on continuous with AI servo and just blasted frame after frame after frame as these cars just whizzed by me. And it was just a use of panning technique to make sure that I froze the action and blurred out the background where the drivers were. And it actually resulted in the photo getting published by the newspaper that sponsored me for the shoot. I was Jensen Button. He actually came in fifth, I believe. And I'll probably get some flack if that wasn't the position he came in the American Grand Prix here recently, but I was shooting for him and I had my nice lanyard around my neck and I was walking next to people shooting 1DXs and D4Ss with huge telephoto lenses, and I did just fine without overcomplicating it. And it really humbled me to be able to listen to that advice back then as a listener and student of photoclasses.com and just walk up to the press credentials area and show my passport and say, hey, I'm Darren Miller and this is my friend Logan Yard. We're here to pick up our press passes. And it was such a fun day. And I just think that everybody needs to take that learning experience with sports photography. If they want to get into it, find someone from a small town, write a local sports editor, say, hey, I'll shoot the photos for you for free. The worst thing they're going to say is no. You might have to do some work to fill out the application, but it's such an awesome experience. So Darren now can tell Darren back then, have a little bit more confidence because it's going to be okay. And don't overcomplicate it by bringing gear that you think you might need and you actually won't use.
That's awesome. We've got a lot of positive feedback, Darren, since you joined the podcast, of just so many people saying how helpful it is to have you on the show since, you know, I think a lot of people relate to you, you know, knowing, you know, where you've come from and where you're going, the things that you're accomplishing. And so they feel, you know, that, you know, when they hear that advice to try to get into a pro event to shoot sports, they understand that trepidation, that fear you have. And so I think it's awesome that you provide that perspective to the show. Let's go to the next question about exposure.
Hi, Jim. My name is Joni Kimball from JoniKimball.com. I'm from Royal Oak, Michigan, and my question is, how can I properly and quickly expose my images? I almost always get it wrong. All my pictures are too dark. Can you help? I just discovered your podcast, and I really enjoy it. Thanks a lot.
Boy, all of her pictures are too dark. The first thing that I would check for, if we're still having kind of this problem, if we're kind of in real beginner territory, is to check your exposure compensation. If you're shooting in aperture priority mode or shutter priority mode, check that you haven't pressed the plus minus button and scrolled the wheel to make sure it puts the little cursor in the middle. And that's going to make sure that your camera is properly exposing. Because if all of your photos are underexposed, that's what I would look at. If it's something else, if you're, you know, shooting in manual and you just keep going too dark, then it may be the way that your LCD is. You know, maybe your LCD brightness is turned up too much, so it looks brighter than it is. And then when you get it on the computer, you say, oh, shoot, it's really dark. So those are a couple things to look at if all your photos are underexposed. But I've never heard of anything that could happen with your camera that would cause this. So it must just be a little bit of a user error, something like that, as we're starting to use the camera. Let's go to the next question right now.
Hey, Jim. My name is Will Flammer. I'm a landscape photographer from Princeton, New Jersey. And you can find my work at throughthefadinglight.tumblr.com. So my question is about image quality. I just bought a Nikon D750, and I'm currently using the View NX2 software that came with it. I'm hoping to upgrade to Lightroom at some point, but I haven't gotten there yet, so this is what I have at the moment. And when I'm editing my files in the software, the image quality is great. It's the way that I feel like it should be for a full-frame camera. It looks sharp and it's high quality. But when I'm saving my files as either high-quality JPEGs or TIFFs, there's a noticeable loss in quality. It's less sharp. It looks a little muddier. And I'm wondering why that's happening. I'm wondering if there's something that I can do differently to process the image or save the image differently, or whether View NX2 is just really inadequate software and there's nothing that I can do about it. Thanks for taking my question. Love the podcast. Keep up the good work. Thanks.
This is a head scratcher. Darren, I'm sure you've noticed we get questions like this fairly frequently, that somebody says things look great in the photo editor. They, you know, save, they export, and suddenly the photo is just looking horrible. And, you know, I'm always a little bit puzzled by this because, you know, if it were any serious bug in the software, we'd probably know about it. And View NX is not a subpar program. It works great, and you're going to get excellent image quality. In fact, some of the things that they do may be better than what you can get in Lightroom and Photoshop, especially as you're saving to JPEG. So there's nothing wrong with it at all. If you're seeing this kind of consistent problem and it's a significant reduction in sharpness or something, it's probably not the software. Something is wrong. Two things that I can tell you to look at, although it really is just a little bit of a head scratcher when I hear these, because I've never personally seen this issue on a computer, and so I'm not totally sure what could be causing this. But we do hear about it frequently, not just with View NX, but with you know, lots of different programs, you know, with Lightroom and Photoshop as well. First thing is, what is the program you're opening the photo in? Because if you're exporting the photo and then you're putting it up on Facebook or something, and then you say, oh, it doesn't look as sharp, well, that's Facebook's problem. Or if you're opening it up and you're opening it up in Paint, well, maybe Paint isn't doing a good job of rendering the photo that you've exported, that JPEG. So check that. If you're just opening it up in kind of a junky program, then yeah, it may just not look real good. And then the second thing is, check your export settings to make sure you haven't like really, really lowered the quality. You know, make sure you're saving it your highest possible quality and at the right resolution for the output that you're going to see. Other than that, it's a head scratcher.
Yeah, it's totally a head scratcher. And as we said in the past, where we have these head scratchers, feel free to go over to the show notes. It's improvephotography.com/93. And go ahead and comment if you can help this user out with a question. That's the great thing about our community, is they're more than willing to lend a little bit of information should they be able to help find a resolution for this listener.
Yeah, absolutely. If you've seen the problem before, anything like that, please let us know. And you know, tell us if there's another situation, another possible solution that they can look at. Well, before we go on, we want to take a second and thank Animoto. Animoto has brought the Improved Photography Podcast to you. And Animoto is an awesome platform for making really high quality slideshows very fast and pretty cost efficiently as well. One of probably the thing that gets me most excited about Animoto are two things. One is, it's not like just a regular flip through your photos transition like you're going to get if you, you know, make your just a quick slideshow in Lightroom or something. You know, you can do just a basic slideshow in a lot of different programs. But the cool thing that Animoto is going to do for you is they're professionally designed. It looks nice, much more than just fade, photo. It's a lot more interesting, and you can toss in videos in between it. And the second thing that I really love is that they source their music from a high quality source. So you have nice, professional, you know, radio quality music on your slideshow, and you don't have to have like some, you know, ding, 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 ding little MIDI file because, you know, either you're going to license it from somebody that can, like Animoto, that can get you a high quality song, or you're going to steal the song, or you're going to have junky music. It's just always happens. So I really love Animoto, and the price to do it, to add to your portfolio of things you can offer your clients, is pretty low if you're running a business.
And it's also pushed me to want to work more with video. So as I have some upcoming wedding shoots coming up, I would definitely want to have my DSLR handy and then also have a little recorder there so I can get the reactions of the groom and the bride walking down the aisle, because that's very important. And if you're going to deliver that to them in a wedding context, I think that that would just add value, as Jim said, to your portfolio of offerings as far as services that you can give to your upcoming clients.
And another cool thing about doing that is I get asked pretty frequently if I'm shooting a wedding, they'll say, can you do the wedding video too? Because they just see guy with camera. Oh, good. He can take the video too. And it's not something that I can take on. I can't do the stills and the video in the same time. A couple of photographers do it. I admire it. I don't see how that could be possible. And so I always have to tell them, sorry, you're going to have to hire a separate videographer. But with Animoto, you can say, you know, I can't do the whole video for you, but I can do some really good, high quality video clips that we can include and make you a high quality professional slideshow that includes some of those clips of like when the bride is walking down the aisle, you know, those very important moments that they just might want a little bit of video. And then it's something you can offer to those clients at a very, very low cost. An awesome, awesome thing to add. Well, you can get started with Animoto by going to animoto.com/improve, and you'll get 10% off your pro subscription. So be sure to go to animoto.com/improve, and we thank them for their support of the podcast. Well, we have tons more questions, so let's go to the next one about diffraction. Time to get geeky.
Hi, Jim. This is Dotan calling from Israel. I recently ran into some articles about lens diffraction, which causes a loss of sharpness at small apertures. I wanted to ask if you ever ran into this problem and what your opinions are about this. Thanks a lot. Love your podcast.
Diffraction is when you close down your aperture so far that it messes up the light rays coming through the lens and causes a reduction in sharpness. So if you use too high of an aperture, it's going to cause diffraction. On some lenses, it's much worse than others. But generally, I would say if you're shooting on a crop sensor camera and you have a lot of depth of field anyway, I like my go-to aperture for landscapes is usually around f/16. If you're on a full frame, maybe pump it up to 18. You can definitely go up to f/22. On most lenses, stopping up above f/22, you know, you're at f/28, f/32, f/40, you're going to start to see diffraction in a really, really serious way. And so just know when you want that full depth of field and you're shooting a landscape, something like that, you know, let's make f/22 generally our limit. There are times, very rarely, where I've said, you know, let's try it. But, you know, if you're going way up there with your aperture, you're going to see problems. Best thing that I can suggest to you is just try it. Grab a tripod, lock your camera on it, and try a photo at f8, f16, f18, f22, f40. And if your lens goes that high, some lenses do. Some lenses will stop at f22. And just check out the image, see what the image quality is. But generally, I'm going to say f/22 should be our limit. All right, let's go to our next question about wedding photography.
Hi, my name is Justin. I'm from Madison Heights, Michigan. My question is about lighting. When I'm at wedding reception, I like to shoot vertically. So if I have my speed light on the top of my camera, I get a strange, you know, weird shadow from the left-hand side. The other option I have is to carry around a light stand with my speed light on it and an umbrella on it, which can get in people's way. Is there another option that I would be able to use where I can get some full lighting without getting in people's way by carrying around a cumbersome light stand? Thank you.
Sounds like the man needs a flash bracket. What do you think, Darren?
Flash bracket, or I was just thinking of using a YN560 with the flash bender off camera just to bend the flash so we had the even lighting projected onto our subjects.
Yeah, for wedding photography, you know, when I'm shooting the couple and we're doing their official portraits, I like to have off camera flash for sure, and I'll have an assistant to move around the flash. But it sounds like he's just shooting, you know, while the couple's dancing, the wedding reception, that kind of thing. What I do is I just put the flash right on the camera, and I'll use a flash bender is my favorite thing for doing this. It's pretty inexpensive, and it just makes the flash a little bit bigger and allows you to bounce it around, and you get really nice quality results. I like to keep it simple, especially shooting a wedding. It's mostly about capturing moments than it is about, wow, look at that incredible lighting in that photo when you're shooting the reception. You want to do the best you can, but if you have a complicated setup, you're going to miss the moments.
Yeah, and since he likes shooting in portrait mode and having it on top of the camera, what I was suggesting is just having the flash bender on there and holding it kind of like Dustin did in one of the photoclasses.com tutorials. It actually acts almost like a softbox if you use it off camera and just hold it in one hand and then shoot the portrait shot with your other hand. So that's just one suggestion just based on knowledge, you know.
Oh, that's a good point. I had forgotten that Dustin does that, and he did shoot that way actually pretty often when I shot with him, is he would just hold that flash and run it off camera, you know, wirelessly, and then he'd just hold the flash in one hand and the camera in the other and just shoot. It's a little bit weird, but it absolutely works. The other option, if you don't want to do that, you don't want to have both hands full, you know, you want two hands to operate your camera, is you can get a flash bracket that just simply, it's puts your flash just on near the camera, just a little bit off from where it normally is on the hot shoe. And then when you shoot in portrait orientation, you just flip the bracket around, and then you can put the flash up without it making those. Because if you have the flash off hanging off the side and you're shooting up and down orientation, it puts weird shadows on. So the flash bracket's what fixes that.
Oh, for sure.
All right. Next question is about which camera to buy.
Hi, Jim. This is James Ventulo from Salem, Massachusetts. I'm calling because I am currently not a photographer, and I'm looking to pick out the perfect camera for me, and hoping you can help me with this. I kind of have my sights set on the Canon 7D, and with the Mark II possibly coming out,
it already
I'm wondering
did.
If I should wait mm-hmm. for that. Also, there is the Canon 70D, which seems very appealing to me, but I'm not interested in doing video. Any advice? Oh, and then there's the Micro Four Thirds category, which also seems very appealing with the smaller cameras and the full-frame sensors coming out. It's a bit confusing. I was just hoping that you could steer me in the right direction. Also, really missed SEO. Tell him we give him our best. Thank you.
All right. Big virtual hug coming from the internet to Dustin. I'll be sure to tell him. You know, this is tough because he's saying what camera does he buy, but he didn't give us, you know, a budget or what specifically he wants to do with it. And so, you know, just about any camera out there is good these days. It's just really going to depend on what kind of personal preferences you have for different things. So maybe we can walk through a few different scenarios, Darren, and just talk about kind of what camera you would recommend for different people. So maybe we can put like the Canon 7D and Mark II, the new one, and the comparable camera would be the Nikon D7100, which I don't know. I'd put the Canon 7D Mark II up there, but there it's also more expensive. Mm-hmm. So there's that level that's, you know, around $17 to $2,000. Then you could get a Canon Rebel T5i or a Nikon D3300 or D5200, you know, a camera like that. Or you could get something in between, like a 70D, a Nikon D7100, something in that range. Or you could go, you know, mirrorless, pick something like a Fuji X-T1, something like that. So there are just so many different options. Who would you put in what camp? When would you recommend each one of those different cameras, Darren?
I would recommend it all. It's really hard, like you said, without a context, a price, a budget, and things like that. But I would probably start out with maybe the lower cost, the economy options of the DSLRs, and then you're probably going to grow into the mid-range ones. And even if you were to step right into the mid-range ones, depending on how avid you become with photography, you might find yourself pushing yourself towards the Nikon D750 or the 7D Mark II, and then the camera manufacturers, of course, want you to try to jump into full frame thereafter. So you just kind of have to ask yourself a question of what am I going to do with my photography, and do I think at all whether or not I'm going to outgrow this camera body or this system, because there are limitations on the mirrorless systems with Micro Four Thirds, with lenses and batteries and things like that. They are coming along. They are catching up rather swiftly. But if you pick one system, I think right now, for at least the next 10 years, unless they don't change their way of thinking, you're safe going with Nikon or Canon and just buying an entry level one and working your way up. That's exactly what my father did. He bought the SL1 from Canon, thought it was a great little camera, and then realized that, you know, the 6D met more of his needs and was able to actually trade his SL1 in towards the purchase of a lens that he, you know, found appropriate for his needs. So it just depends on the context, how much you're going to use the camera, and, you know, whether you think there's potential for growth within your photography.
Yeah, I think that potential for growth is an important factor here is, you know, what's your trajectory? Is your goal that eventually I'm going to be shooting, you know, professional sports, or, you know, eventually I want to have a wildlife calendar? Then I'm going to say, no, there's not even a question. You have to pick the DSLR. There's not a question. That's what you need to pick. And probably Canon. I'm going to give Canon's a big super telephoto lenses the edges right now. But, you know, if you are on a budget and you want a travel camera and you just want it to be small and lightweight that you can fit in your pocket, then not even a question, go pick the Fuji X-T1. You know, it really depends on what kind of thing you're looking for. But I think looking at the trajectory of where you want to go with photography is a really good way of getting started. Well, in every episode, we like to share a doodad, something that we like, something that we want to talk about. Darren, do you have a doodad to recommend for today?
Yes, I actually came up with a newer one. I have to do a little bit more research on it. It's called Milio or Milio, and I might be butchering the pronunciation of it, but an actual student of ours from photoclasses.com recommended it, sent us a link, and I went over and visited it, and it's really almost like using your sliders within Lightroom to adjust everything from clarity to vibrance, giving you pretty much complete control to do global adjustments. I didn't see anything for doing adjustments for, you know, fine adjustments using a layering mask or using a brush or something like that that wouldn't affect the whole photo. But the really neat thing about this is that as you're doing the adjustments in this video, which I'll link over to in the show notes, you can see the adjustments being done on a MacBook Pro, but also at the exact time in real time, they're reflected on the iPad and the iPhone. And they also work for PCs and various tablet manufacturers as well too. So the thought behind it is not only are you getting an editing software that syncs up with all your devices so you can pick up where you left off on one device to the next, but also you're maintaining backups, redundancy of backups between all those devices as well, which of course is space permitting. But if you're getting into a serious photography library, I can see its limitations, but if you're just starting out, I think this would be nice, because I think maybe this should be the direction that Lightroom should look to go some way, because it's so cumbersome. And I'm not jealous of you at all, Jim, when you have to come back and get your images off of your MacBook Pro back into your Lightroom catalog once you get back from Iceland, because that is a cumbersome and clunky process right now.
Yeah, it really is. I wish that were a little bit better. Well, speaking of Iceland, since I am in Iceland right now when you're here this recording, one thing that I picked up for the trip, since it's a long flight, is the Nature Power 80026 Power Bank Elite 25 portable battery with 3 USB charging ports and 1 AC outlet. Woo! It is awesome. It's just this little brick of power. And so you can charge your cell phone from it. You can charge any laptop because it's a regular wall outlet that it has, a regular U.S. standard ones. I'm sure you can get it for other countries as well. And it has a huge battery in it. You can charge even a regular Mac laptop 2 times. You can charge an iPhone 6 to 8 times, depending on which battery you have. It's just this little brick of power, fairly lightweight. And I'm going to be using this as I'm on the road shooting at different locations. You know, if you're, oh man, I forgot to charge my camera battery while I was in the hotel last night, and so I only have one battery to last me the whole day. You got your power brick. You can just plug it in right there and charge it up. You know, cell phones often run out of battery as you're traveling around in the woods in the middle of nowhere because your camera's, you know, your phone's always searching for signal if you forget to turn it on airplane mode, etc. And so you just got your power. It's all right there. If you need a little civilization while you're out there, you got it. And especially for, you know, while I'm on the plane, I want something to charge my Mac laptop. But if you have the Mac Pro Retina, there's no external battery available, period, that can do it. So this one has a regular AC wall outlet to do it. So I really like it. It's kind of expensive, about $200. They make but I got one for $150 they have on Amazon. And I think it's a pretty good deal for what it is.
Awesome. How is it on weight? Is it pretty heavy or is it okay?
You know, I don't have it in my hands yet. I've ordered it and it should be here tomorrow. It weighs 2 pounds. So, you know, there's some weight to it, but it's not exactly, you know, she's an average size, we might call it. There's some weight to it in your bag, but to be able to power all of my devices, since it's a regular wall outlet, I don't know. I think it's worth it.
Oh, that sounds awesome. I'll have to take a look at one of those.
Very cool. Well, thank you all for joining us in this episode of the podcast. And be sure to check out improvephotography.com/travel group. And you can see where we're going traveling next to do our free photo workshop series. And come join us on a shoot. See you, everybody.
Bye-bye.